Holy War in Islam by Abdul Masih. Islam is not a religion in the usual sense, because it considers itself a theocracy in which Allah reigns. This theocracy is to be realized in an Islamic state in which the Sharia, or the Muslim law, rules. The ultimate aim of Islam is a religious state. In such a government, politics and faith are not to be separated but joined. Democracy is not viable in Islam, since there is only one ruler, Allah. His people are to submit to him unconditionally. The will of Allah was revealed to Muhammad through the text of the Quran. It is also understood through the Hadith, which contains the oral traditions of what Muhammad said besides the Quran. From these revealed words of Allah and the Sunnah, Muhammad's example, the Sharia was developed, by which Allah orders his kingdom on earth. This divine law encompasses all aspects of a Muslim's experience, prescribing and regulating every detail in spiritual matters, such as confession of faith, prayer, fasting, almsgiving, and pilgrimage, and also practical matters, such as family life, inheritances, business, contracts, legalities, war, slavery, and penalties. Islam in Arabic means submission or surrender, not only as a voluntary yielding, but also as a subjugation by force. Islam is a missionary-minded religion, aiming to conquer the whole world for Allah. Thus, the Sharia should not be understood as a moral ideal, but as a law which is to be put into practice by constraint if necessary. It demands an executor with the authority to enforce. Allah ruled the Muslims first through Muhammad and then through his successors, the Caliphs, whose duty was to guard the law and carry it out. Through these leaders, many conquered countries were brought into Islam, either willingly or by compulsion. Immediately after Muhammad died, a dispute arose concerning who his rightful successor should be. Till today, the Sunnis acknowledge the first four Caliphs as the Prophet's legitimate successors. The Shiites, however, believe that Ali, Muhammad's son-in-law and nephew, should have immediately become the ruler over all the Muslims and the vicar of Allah. After Ali's assassination by his allies, the Kharijites, there arose among them, the Shiites, a succession of imams who were considered their highest authorities. Some Shiites acknowledged seven imams, whereas others recognized 12. Later on, the Ayatollahs viewed themselves as mediums of their last imam, receiving direct instructions from him to implement Islamic law, thus fulfilling the will of Allah on earth. Muhammad founded a state-oriented religion under the authority of the law. Christ, on the contrary, frees all who follow him from the condemnation and punishment of the Old Testament law by granting them forgiveness and the power of the Holy Spirit to fulfill his commands. Christians are no longer under law, but in grace. Muslims strive under the demanding law of Islam and are obliged to obey it with the ultimate aim of setting up an Islamic state, the kingdom of Allah on earth. Christians, however, live in the spirit of their Lord and seek to establish the spiritual kingdom of God through their love and fellowship, not by political striving or might. Holy war, al-jihad, in Islam is the obligation of all Muslims to fight against unbelievers or non-Muslims. Whoever wants to understand the steps and facets of holy war should study the events in the life of Muhammad, because Islam can be considered an exposition of its prophet. Whereas Christians are called spiritually to put off their fallen nature and put on Christ, their new nature, Colossians 3:8-10. Muslims are allowed to continue wearing their old human nature and to wrap themselves with the cloak of Muhammad. The Prophet's words, deeds, and the way of life are the main sources of Islamic law. It is a duty for Muslims to live as their Prophet lived, to be guided by his example, to be clothed and covered with him. Chapter 1. The Passive Phase of Holy War. Islam was first instituted in Muhammad's family. His wife, Khadijah, persuaded him that he was indeed a prophet of Allah. She also convinced her four daughters to acknowledge their father's prophethood. When Muhammad proclaimed Islam during his first years in Mecca, he was protected and supported mainly by Khadija's wealth and influence. Thus, the original Islamic community was a family unit, not a spiritual brotherhood. Even today, the base and nucleus of Islam is the authority of the family or clan. When establishing an Islamic community, Muslims try to win the chief of a tribe or a clan who, if he converts, will then govern according to Islamic principles. Consequently, all the tribe will embrace Islam too. Anyone who tries to abandon Islam is to be re-educated, punished, or killed by his own family. The family in Islam is responsible for all of its members remaining loyal to their faith. As time passed, Abu Bakr, a rich merchant in Mecca, joined Islam and freed some slaves with his money. Actually, he bought them for Islam. With this influx of men into the family community, prayer could no longer be held in Muhammad's home because the majority of his family members were female. So the group met in a secluded valley near Mecca for prayer. With this development, Islam exceeded the bounds of Muhammad's family, becoming an independent community and a religious fellowship. But the gatherings in the valley were held in secret. Today, Muslims who leave their homeland still worship Allah in privacy when their members constitute a minority. They form cell groups as a base for future growth. They will continue meeting in this way until their numbers increase. When the praying Muslims in the isolated valley near Mecca were discovered, they were mocked and scorned for their unusual way of worship. This prompted them to step into the public eye and pray openly before all. Muhammad began to warn the inhabitants of Mecca, "Recognize that all your handmade idols are nothing. There is no God but Allah. We worship the only true God." This message aroused stern opposition in the hearts of the Meccans toward the Muslims who bore the offense and hatred silently without retaliation. Owing to their limited number, they did not have the necessary power to unleash verbal attacks against the antagonistic majority. However, their active silence, unwavering determination in the face of opposition, and firm witness before the people in Mecca drew others into their small community. To suffer silently without defense is a preliminary and essential step in holy war. This principle is practiced when Muslims are small in number among an opposing majority. Chapter 2. The War of Words in Islam. As time passed, some influential merchants, strong fighters, and freed slaves joined Islam and reinforced the small community. This encouraged Muhammad to step forward and defend his so-called revelations publicly and to enter into verbal warfare. Muhammad was a brilliant spokesman and a gifted orator, rebutting his enemies with ease in a breathtaking war of words. Mecca had been a religious center for most of the Arabian Peninsula for a long time. During holy months, Bedouins and merchants made their way to Mecca to worship at the numerous idolatrous shrines and altars. Muhammad mocked the hundreds of lifeless statues there and proclaimed, "La Allah illallah, there is no God except Allah." The rich in Mecca, who gained some of their wealth from the pilgrims visiting the Kaaba and its temples, strictly forbade their slaves to follow Muhammad. They hated the new prophet and accused him of being crazy, possessed, or bewitched by evil spirits. Others called him a fortune teller and a poet in direct contact with the spirits. A number of slaves would not give up following Muhammad. They were beaten severely, and some of them died as martyrs for the sake of Islam. This, then, is another step in holy war where Muslims live as a minority to suffer physically for Allah and to die for Islam when necessary. In order to understand the Arab mindset, one should recognize the importance of the verbal duel among the pre-Islamic Bedouins. It was customary for two feuding tribes to line up and face each other on opposite sides. Initially, the armed parties did not exchange blows with weapons. Instead, each group delegated a poet to mock and curse the enemy with spontaneous verses of hatred. This linguistic warrior then praised the glory and strength of his own tribe. That group, which found itself without a reply at the end of the lyrical battle, was considered defeated and left in shame. In keeping with this tradition, Muhammad accepted the challenges of his enemies. He vanquished them with stunning words of combat arrayed in captivating rhythmical stanzas. Contending with words is essential in holy war. Nasser, Gaddafi, Khomeini, and Saddam Hussein have used fighting with majestic words in a masterly way. By their oral expressions, they have brought heaven down and hell up. They were well aware that their threats would not necessarily be put into effect. Neither were their arguments based fully on truth. Nonetheless, they endeavored to sound bombastic, arousing sentiment, and instilling a superior sense of victory. No one should take such words too seriously today, but it would also be unwise to underestimate them. An active attack could ensue when one party feels that the other has become weak or fearful. The war of words is actually a war of nerves, and he who manifests a steady patience and blasts his enemy away with a storm of threatening words is the one who will emerge champion. Chapter 3, The Immigration and Flight of the Muslims. The opposition of the majority in Mecca toward Muhammad and all Muslims continued to increase. The total boycott against him involved all who followed or guarded him. As a result, they could no longer buy or sell. Without the protection of their tribes, solitary Muslims lived under constant threat of death. Muhammad found shelter in the company of his rich wife, Khadija, and his paternal uncle, Abu Talib, who headed a large and strong family. No enemy dared touch the Prophet out of fear of his powerful clan. The traditional obligations of the tribe forced Muhammad's relatives to guard their extraordinary kinsmen, despite their true feelings toward him. Thus, the rule of family protection shielded Islam, which would otherwise have been blotted out at its inception. When the persecution against the destitute and defenseless Muslims reached the point where it could no longer be endured, Muhammad suggested that 83 of his followers should flee to Abyssinia, which is today Ethiopia. There the Nagus, or the king, offered them refuge. Later on, the Meccans requested this ruler to return the followers of Muhammad as their slaves, but the Muslims defended their faith in a public debate. They declared that Islam was a religion similar to Christianity. Reciting passages of the Quran, they confessed that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary, that he performed great miracles, and ascended into heaven where he lives near God. They did not reveal the unbridgeable differences between the Bible and the Quran. Neither did they expose their rejection of Christ's divinity and crucifixion. When the Muslims had finished with their defense, the Nagus was convinced about their religion. He granted them asylum, despite the demands of Mecca's merchants. Through their compassion and ignorance of the essence behind the new faith, the Christians of Abyssinia actually rescued Islam. They demonstrated their love to the persecuted Muslims through good deeds, offering their homes, lands, and protection. Yet they failed to evangelize them. They did not lead the newcomers to the real Christ. This shows us that social sacrifices alone are insufficient. These must be based on evangelistic outreach. Islam grew and developed in a Christian environment where the Muslims were treated kindly. Many Muslim workers and students in the Christian West today live in a similar situation. In the best cases, these aliens receive social care and friendship, but seldom do they hear a clear Christian witness. We need to learn that good deeds are inadequate unless accompanied with Christian testimony and teaching. If we show love but never proclaim the truth, we nurture and strengthen anti-Christian forces. Even though the Abyssinian Christians failed to present the gospel to the Muslims in its full scope, Muhammad did acknowledge their love. In the Quran, he says that the Christians are the best of the enemies of the Muslims because they showed practical concern, mercy, and kindness to them when they were refugees, taken from Surah Iron 57, verse 27, and the Table, chapter 5, verse 82. When the persecutions against the Muslims in Mecca grew more fierce, Muhammad went through a moment of despair and lapsed. Formerly, he had lashed out fearlessly against polytheism, But now he suddenly declared the possibility of Allah having a wife named Al-Lat and two daughters, Al-Uzza and Manat. Surah, the star, chapter 53, verse 20 through 23. This was a wily compromise on Muhammad's behalf, for the boycott of the Meccan leaders against him was lifted immediately and life returned to normal. When the Muslims in Abyssinia heard that Muhammad had compromised with the polytheists, they wondered why they should continue to remain far from their families and homes, so they started to return to Mecca. Meanwhile, Muhammad regretted his failure and confessed that he had hearkened to the whispering of Satan. He considered the words in Surah, the star, as, quote, satanic verses. He justified his error by claiming that all previous prophets had been tempted by demonic influence. Surah, the Pilgrimage, chapter 22, verses 52 and 53. The satanic verses in the Quran are not the invention of author Salman Rushdie, but have their origin in the personal recitation of Muhammad. Salman Rushdie merely used the impure allusion about Allah and his women and developed it into an obscene story. As a result, Muslims accuse him of blasphemy and totally reject his book. It is the duty of any Muslim who encounters him to murder him. The killing of blasphemers is a law in holy war. A sincere repentance may release a blasphemer from the punishment of death, but not necessarily. The vital issue concerning the satanic verses is neither Rushdie's book nor Muhammad's limited sanction of polytheism. The crux of the matter is Muhammad's failure to distinguish the voice of God from that of Satan. He opened his mind to the whisperings of Satan, and by not immediately rejecting the message, he showed his incompetence as a prophet and inability to discern truth from falsehood. This episode raises the question of whether there are more satanically inspired verses in the Quran or whether the whole of the Quran is perhaps of satanic origin. When the refugees returned from Abyssinia to Mecca, they discovered that the boycott against Islam had been put back into effect, more severely than before. Because Muhammad had rejected his compromise, calling his previous revelation the satanic verses, thus, a second immigration to Abyssinia ensued. From these events, we have to conclude that Islam considers it unnecessary to stand and fight to the bitter end. Muslims have the right to emigrate and flee when the need dictates such a course. This is an approved option in holy war. Away from an imminent danger, Islam can grow and gain strength for future hostile encounters. Muhammad's first wife, Khadija, and paternal uncle, Abu Talib, died in the same year. The prophet was left without protection and faced the threat of death. He left for Taif, a town high above Mecca, with the hope of finding refuge. The merchants there preferred to live at peace with Mecca, however, so they drove Muhammad out of town with a hail of stones. Muhammad escaped to the desert town between Taif and Mecca, overwhelmed with despair. There he tried to calm himself with the recitation of some surahs. This event is mentioned twice in the Quran, with a special remark that Allah himself guided jinn, or spirits, to him so that they could hear his recitation. It's found in Surah the Jinn, chapter 72, verses 1 through 15. These jinn were deeply impressed by the verses, accepted the message, and became Muslims. However, they remained barred from heaven. In Surah, the Sand Dunes, chapter 46, verse 28 through 31, we can read confirmation of the personal encounters between Muhammad and the jinn. According to the Quranic verses, these spirits claim to influence the people living under their jurisdiction and to warn them not to refuse Islam, for everlasting fire would be the consequence of such a choice. It is vital to understand that Muslims are not only men and women, but also spirits who have accepted the Quran and decided to take an active part in the spread of Islam. It remains an alarming aspect of holy war that the jinn participate in furthering Islam along with their human collaborators. The influence of spiritual forces in the natural realm is reality. The Apostle Paul experienced this and declared, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Ephesians 6:12. The conversion of 73 animists in Yathrib to Islam within 2 years after Muhammad's expulsion from Taif may be the result of spiritual intervention by the jinn. The people of this town accepted the new faith before Muhammad had ever set foot there. As soon as Muhammad encountered the new group of Muslims from Yathrib, he made 3 consecutive contracts with them, urging them to accept all persecuted Muslims from Mecca, not only as refugees, but as blood brothers, sharing with them their homes, food, and even their inheritances. Through the contracts, Muhammad paved the way for his followers in Mecca to emigrate to Yathrib. These slipped away one by one. After some months, the entire community of Islam had emigrated to Yathrib, settling in the homes of the Muslims there. Muhammad and Abu Bakr concluded this great exodus to Yathrib in AD 622. Yathrib has since then been called Al-Madina, meaning the city, with the emphasis on the article, for it was the only town that granted Muhammad and his followers asylum. Muhammad did not leave Mecca by faith without guarantee, but by written contract. He did not believe that Allah would protect and care for him. He arranged agreements for all areas of his community's social life to provide security in this world for himself and his followers. Muhammad was not willing to die for his call or his companions. He fled to preserve his life and fought on for Islam. Chapter 4, The Radical Change of Holy War in Medina. The Hijra, the immigration or flight, of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina in AD 622, was a turning point for Islam. In Mecca, Muhammad had been a persecuted warner, and his tribe, the Quraysh, deemed him a contemptible prophet. He suffered greatly and more than once had experienced a close brush with death. But in Medina, the situation changed. There he became a skilled statesman and a distinctive lawgiver, demonstrating a high degree of political expertise. Whereas he had formerly been a persecuted prophet in Mecca, he now gloried in his status as a superior ruler in Medina. Muslims assessed this significant change of events and developed their own calendar beginning with the year of the Hijra. The calendar of Islam does not begin with the birth of Muhammad or the onset of his so-called revelations, neither with the assembling of the first Islamic community nor the flight of the Muslim refugees to Abyssinia. All the persecutions, war of words, martyrdoms, and whatever else had been suffered during the 12 Meccan years was not considered the start of the new religion. Only when Islam became a state in Medina, where faith took shape in political form, was Islam regarded as established. All preceding developments and incidents were merely preparatory for the Islamic state in which the Sharia must reign. Christians should understand that the primary aim of Islam is not the spiritual well-being of Muslims or their faithful worship through prayers and pilgrimage. Its ultimate purpose is the establishment of the kingdom of Allah on earth now through the implementation of Islamic law in an Islamic state. Muslims in Europe and America may emphasize humanistic interest and social concern, but they are only idealizing or spiritualizing their religion and are somewhat naive as to its true goal, the seizure of political power by all means. Some Muslims may realize this, but do not like to confess it. They hide the real aim of their faith, fulfilling the advice of Muhammad, who once said, "Holy war means trickery." We should never forget that Islam cannot exist merely as a religion, for it is based on the Sharia and has developed into a political, economic, and proselytizing superpower which seeks to institute the all-encompassing Muslim state everywhere. Its appearance in various forms and systems is only preliminary to this prime objective. In the United States and Europe, Muslims are presently trying to establish political parties and unions for Muslim workers. They seek to gain enough votes so as to introduce Muslim candidates into their respective legislative systems. They are striving for accredited legal status. even in predominantly Christian countries where they live as minorities. Chapter 5, Attacks on the Caravans of Mecca. After Muhammad arrived with his followers in Medina, being welcomed enthusiastically by the Muslims there, he and his group were soon faced with serious social problems. Sheltering refugees over a long period is not easy, and practical problems developed regarding living space, work, property, and the distribution of inheritances. The refugees from Mecca grew poor. Their resources dwindled. The Medina Muslims, on the other hand, possessed all necessities of life and became progressively more wealthy. Confronted with this injustice, Muhammad became aware of his obligation to help those Muslims who had fled with him from Mecca. The most pressing need of the hour was for him to establish some source of income for them. Otherwise, his community stood in danger of disintegration. But where else could he go for goods and funds, if not to the inhabitants of Mecca, who had previously confiscated the possessions of his followers? Muhammad began to summon his followers to holy war and incited them to attack and plunder the caravans of Mecca. His fellow believers objected strongly to participation in such raids, knowing that those against whom they would be fighting were their own kinsmen, who, although unbelievers, were still cherished relatives. Blood bonds among the Arabs are often valued more than spiritual alliances. While living in Mecca under the protection of their relatives, the Muslims understood the holy war to be a verbal defense of their faith as a suffering minority. But in Medina, Muhammad changed the concept of holy war. Out of the phase of passing suffering arose a strategy of active defense, escalating to methodical, hostile attack, which advanced in every direction under the sun. Muhammad began a systematic indoctrination of his Muslim community. In a short time, he formed an aggressive band, resolute even in the face of death, out of what had previously been a contemplative, prayerful group that fasted and waited in fearful expectation for the day of judgment. At the first call to military ambush, the Muslims opposed the fighting and abandoned Muhammad. They preferred prayer and making themselves ready for the afterlife to warfare and the spilling of blood. They said openly, "Allah has not predestined us for holy war." It's found in Surah, the Woman, chapter 4, verses 73 through 80. But Muhammad continued with his religious brainwashing. At first, he tried to rally his followers with direct commands from Allah. He enticed and threatened, made promises and hurled curses, anything to rouse and motivate his community to attack in the name of Allah. But the Muslims valued a modest civilian religious life over battle. Eventually, Muhammad focused his attention on some of his wilder companions, persuading them to raid the caravans from Mecca along with him. But all attempts were unsuccessful. So Muhammad waited until the month of pilgrimage, when all fighting among the Arabs was forbidden under treaty. It was then that Muhammad drove his followers to treacherously attack an unarmed caravan. When the plunderers returned to Medina with their spoil, there was a great uprising. Muslim and Jew alike condemned the attack and wanted nothing to do with the pillage. However, Muhammad understood the mindset of his followers, so he commanded that the camels should remain loaded with a booty in the main square of the town. The rich supply of goods spoke for itself, and after some days the mood of the people changed. With the help of divine revelation, the wares were publicly distributed. Muhammad also revealed a surah of justification for all fighters in holy war. "They will question you concerning the holy month and fighting in it. Say, fighting in it is a great transgression. But to hinder men from the way of Allah and disbelief in him and the holy mosque and to expel its people from it, that is more heinous in Allah's sight. Sedition is worse than killing." Surah, the Cow, chapter 2, verses 216 through 218. With this clever revelation, Muhammad honored an old tradition, followed by all the tribes on the Arabian Peninsula. But he overruled this custom, declaring that the defense of Islam was more important. He admitted that an act of robbery during the holy month was a great transgression. However, to hinder a Muslim from practicing his faith or tempt him to leave Islam was to be considered a crime far greater. With this proclamation from Muhammad, all mission outreach in Muslim lands is condemned. To convert a Muslim to another faith is considered a crime more serious than murder. Mission work among Muslims is never viewed only as a religious enterprise, but as an assault on the Muslim state and an attempt to undermine or overthrow its authority. In Christian countries, Muslims are granted full freedom to proclaim Islam wherever they like and to build mosques anywhere they choose. In Islamic countries, however, all mission work has to remain secret and underground, otherwise it will immediately be eradicated by the state. According to the Sharia, the conversion of a Muslim from Islam to Christianity is an act worthy of death. This sentence is to be enacted either by the state or the convert's own family. Islam is like a harsh taskmaster, issuing absolutely no terms of release for its slaves. Once a Muslim, always a Muslim. The revelation of Muhammad in Surah, the Cow, chapter 2, verses 216 through 218, legitimatized holy war for all Muslims, and a pivotal change took place in the minds of the Prophet's followers after its announcement. In the next raid, 83 immigrant and 231 Medinan Muslims joined forces, for it was Allah who had commanded them to fight for Islam. But the expected Meccan caravan never arrived. The leader of the company had learned of Muhammad's intentions while in Medina, so he turned his caravan in another direction and lured the Muslims into an ambush. As it turned out, 1,000 Meccans met 300 Medinans with a surprise attack. In this decisive battle of Badr in AD 624, the fate of Islam stood on the knife edge. Nearing despair, Muhammad implored the retreating Muslims to fight on, whatever the cost. Amazingly, the unexpected occurred. The Muslims besieged the foe three times their size. Only when they began to collect the spoil did the defeated enemy counterattack, forcing the Muslims to flee. But again, Muhammad rallied his men to his side with fiery cadences of combat, entreating them to rebuff in the name of Allah. At last, and astoundingly, the Muslim force triumphed in a grand victory. Since this crucial event, Muslims believe that Allah fights with them in battle when they defend Islam and spread his message by force. They trust that he will not leave them, but will grant success. With this triumph, Muhammad substantiated his claims regarding his prophethood, the presence of Allah with his people, and the truth of the Quran. Thus, holy war was born, and Islam became a power based on the sword. The booty from the Battle of Badr was not large, so Muhammad seized a number of Meccan fighters, among them some of his own relatives who had refused Islam, and held them hostage until their families paid a high ransom for their release. Among those taken captive was the famous uncle of Muhammad, Abbas, the forefather of the Abbasids. Since this time, hostage taking has been a legal practice in holy war. We should not be too shocked when Muslim terrorists of Islamic states hold hostages for ransom. When Saddam Hussein held many Westerners captive as a shield against superior weaponry during the Persian Gulf crisis, he considered them a special gift from Allah and thanked him for it. Not all of the Muslims were pleased after the victory of Badr. Despite their new standing and the ransom expected in return for the hostages, many were downcast, owing to the fact that their relatives from Mecca had been killed. Muhammad was perturbed and announced an absolution for all fighters in holy war to justify and comfort his sorrowful Muslims. In this revelation, Surah, the Spoils, chapter 8, verse 17, it is written, "You did not kill them, but Allah killed them. You did not shoot when you shot, but Allah did." With this Quranic verse, killing in an Islamic holy war was justified. Allah appeared as an impassioned God of war, an irresistible murdering Lord. If a Muslim kills an enemy in a holy war, he is considered innocent because he has carried out a commendable deed. He has offered himself to Allah and has been an instrument in his hand. The Muslim is not the slayer. Allah is. Wherever Muslims are strong in number and sense a possibility of victory, they wage an attack or spark a revolution. In the Quran, Allah himself orders Muslims to kill the enemies of Islam wherever they happen to find them. Surah is the cow, chapter 2, verse 191, and women, chapter 4, verse 89 and 91, and repentance, chapter 9, verse 29, and so forth. These words are not considered to be commands from Muhammad, but divine revelation. With this principle, Muhammad, under divine approval, opened the door for terrorism. Whenever a Muslim dies in the holy war, he is promised immediate entrance into paradise. Only when dying for Islam will he be exempt from the day of judgment. No Muslim, except a martyr, has the hope of being justified on the fearful last day. Muhammad himself did not die in holy war. According to Islam, he lives in barzakh, an intermediate existence between this life and the hereafter. This means that Muhammad is not yet saved. Whenever a Muslim pronounces the name of Muhammad, he must say, "May Allah pray for him and grant him peace." If the fate of Islam's founder is not yet certain, what will become of the billions who have followed him down through the centuries? According to the Quran, only Muslim martyrs escape from all tears and anxiety. They alone see and experience unspeakable pleasures in everlasting gardens. We should not be astonished that old men and young boys alike were blown to bits in minefields during the wars between Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan and the Soviet Union. Muslims march into death together, with the deceptive confidence that their martyrdom would directly catapult them into paradise. This belief has been a motivating factor in all the holy wars of Islam. There are harsh critics who accuse Christians of also waging wars for their faith. In the minds of many Muslims, the Crusades of the 11th through 13th centuries paint a picture in stark contrast to the virtues of mercy, peace, and love which Christ commanded. Cynically, Libya's leader, Muammar Gaddafi, supports Irish Protestants and Catholics in their unholy war. No one can deny the facts that Christians have fought religious wars, but there is a fundamental difference between fighting in the Quran and the Gospel. In more than 18 Quranic verses, Allah commands Muslims to fight and kill the enemies of Islam. In the Gospel, however, we can read that Jesus commanded his disciple, Peter, to put away his sword. "Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will die by the sword." Matthew 26:52. Jesus forbade defense or attack for his sake or the Gospels. He never trained or encouraged his followers to use weapons or embark on military campaigns. Never did the apostles of Christ defend themselves with a spear or bow and arrow. On the contrary, they suffered flogging, stoning, and death for their master's sake. They surrendered their lives to God Almighty and submitted their destiny into His hands. If He had so chosen, Jesus could have asked for more than 12 legions of angels to protect Him, Matthew 26:53. But He preferred to endure the punishment His enemies deserved. When He shed His blood on the cross, to which He was nailed, He did not curse His tormentors, but prayed, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Luke 23:34. One of the many unbridgeable differences between Jesus and Muhammad is their attitude toward war. When Christians have engaged in religious wars, they have contradicted the command and spirit of their Lord. They will be judged for such actions. But with Muslims, the situation is different. According to their creed, they incur guilt if they do not obey the call of Allah to holy war, for this is a requirement in their faith. When they die as martyrs in a holy war, they are absolved from the day of judgment and enter into everlasting gardens of joy. Whereas religious warfare will result in judgment for Christians on the great and final day, it is a Muslim's only hope for paradise when crowned by martyrdom in holy war. Chapter 6. The Eradication of Enemies in Medina. When Muhammad and his followers had settled in Medina, they encountered a number of strong Jewish clans residing in several of the town's quarters. Among them were clever poets, rich merchants, and learned scribes. These Jews had the might, honor, riches, and power there, and they chose to remain separate from Islam. They mocked the new prophet in secret and resisted his call to submit to the new faith. They were a main source of irritation for Muhammad as they sharply pointed out the differences between the Old Testament and the Quran. As a result, the prophet's authority was questioned, and he, in turn, unleashed his fierce and bitter hatred against them, calling them the greatest enemies of Islam. Surah the Table, 582. At this time, Muhammad could not admit to any mistakes in his revelations. Otherwise, he would have been considered a liar or an incompetent prophet. After Muhammad had won the Battle of Badr and consolidated his authority in Medina, he began to subdue all hostile and neutral forces. He learned who his antagonists and critics were, put the Jewish leaders on his blacklist, and had them killed one by one. Muhammad's followers exerted themselves in wiping out the enemies of their prophet in a zealous effort to vindicate his honor. Muhammad encouraged his followers to be secretive killers for the sake of Islam. This policy is still followed in our day. In 1983, Muslim terrorists in Lebanon drove trucks filled with explosives into the barracks where American and French soldiers were stationed, blowing them to bits. Murdering the enemies of Islam is a fundamental element of holy war. In Medina, Muhammad was able to pit the various Jewish clans against one another. He would isolate one group and blockade their quarter until they surrendered. He forced the Kanaka Jews to flee to Jordan, Surah the Mustering, 59:14, and obliged the Nadir Jews to relinquish their gold and weapons to him before he chased them out of their homes. Some of them emigrated to Syria and others settled in the Khyber Oasis, Surah the Mustering, 59:1-7. When the Khwarizmi Jews conspired with Muhammad's enemies during the siege of Medina, the War of the Ditch, in A.D. 627, he had them dig their own mass grave and then had 600 to 800 of them killed in one day, Ibn Hisham. This was the first mass grave of an Islamic holy war, and it was filled with the bodies of Medinan Jews. Muhammad changed his procedure when he conquered the Jews living outside Medina. He no longer allowed them to immigrate, but forced them to work for him. As half slaves, they were required to yield 50% of their crops. By their repeated victories over the Jews, the Muslims became rich. Muhammad wanted to marry one of his prisoners of war, a Jewess, but she refused to do so legally, so he made her one of his slaves. In an attempt to avenge the death of her relatives, she poisoned the food Muhammad was sharing with a guest. Sensing the toxin, he spit the morsel out immediately, but his guest died soon after. Traces of the poison must have entered Muhammad's body, for he said later, as quoted by Ibn Hisham, "The poison of the Jews has broken my heart." Since this time, it has been whispered that the Jews killed Muhammad, an enduring reason for holy war against them. The hostility between Islam and Israel since 1948 has roots deeper than most people realize. The late Ayatollah Khomeini revealed that his political and religious aim was the conquering of Jerusalem. He inspired the Muslim slogan, "Finally, Jerusalem," for his followers. Yasser Arafat, leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, said that Jerusalem is the quintessence of the entire Middle East problem. Fighting against Israel remains an integral part of the holy war.
Please turn to side 2. Do not rewind. Thank you.